Hello, how are you? Thank you for coming out to this panel. And it's an honor to be on the panel with two people that I've worked with very closely over the years. You know, two people who have been what I call completely involved and committed to this thing called liberation, to this beautiful thing called black folks, and by extension, other folk also too. Because you cannot be passionate about your own people without being passionate about other people also too. It is impossible, and you learn and you grow. Since I had done a foreword for a book of young people's poetry and some of the older people's poetry, and some were some hip-hop artists also too. So I like to read a little section. But how I came into writing is that as a young, when I was born, my mom died when I was 1 year old in a place called Birmingham, Alabama. And I was just at a SALA conference in Birmingham, and I discovered where my mom was buried. I was given a death certificate. She died at 23. And I also discovered the house where I lived until I was 1 year old. So it was an amazing trek to a place called Birmingham, Alabama. But my grandmother came to my father's house and picked me and my sister up and said, "I will take care of you." And she did until I was 5. And when my grandmother died, in fact, I discovered her. I used to go on into the room. She'd take a nap in the afternoon from about 12 until 2, and I came running in. I used to wake her up by jumping on the bed. You know, so I'd jump from one side to the other, and then she would look up and say, "Girl, you better get down," whatever. And I'd jump all over her, and then I jumped off the bed and went running out the door, and I said to my my aunts, who, if you understand Southern culture, they were really my cousins, first cousins, but they were older. But in the South, the older cousins ended up being aunts. And I said to my Aunt Louise, "Mama won't move," and I zoomed out the door. And that was the last time I saw Mama, because she was dead. And as a consequence of this woman who loved me and nurtured me, because I was always outside the realm of things as a child, my sister was the most beautiful woman. She looked just like my mom. And I'd like to give you an example of why I write and how what I come from. I remember my mom, my grandmother was the head deaconess in our church, and the sisters would come in on Saturdays, you know, to cook and snap the beans and whatever. And one day, it was raining outside, so we had to come inside. My sister used to love to play with those little paper dolls, and I never wanted to play with them, and she begged me, so we played with paper dolls and stuff. And one of the old sisters said, "Ooh, Pat, she is so beautiful. She looks just like her mother." And my sister raised her hand for acknowledgement of this, right? And all the old sisters said, "Isn't she beautiful?" And so she looked down and we were playing with the little dolls. And then someone said, "And Sonia." And I raised my hand for appreciation. And they said, "Who does she look like?" And one of the people said, "She looks just like her dad, but she's smart." And I'm always so amazed at how people can form or malform or deform how you will be in your life. Because for the rest of my life, I had to be smart. I had to be the smartest in my class. And believe me, I was that. But also after Mama died, I became a stutterer. And I'm the child that would go, And by the time I got it out, everybody said, oh goodness, no, don't ask her anything, whatever. Even the teacher would pack up her books. I mean, you know, but I also started to write. And when we were shifted from home to home to home, to relative to relative to relative, and I saw one of the houses on the cover of one of the architecture magazines where my sister and I had been shunted off to at some point. And I remember sitting there looking at that house, remembering the big old gothic kind of house that we lived in for a while. I'm the child that when I showed up someplace, they said, "Oh, that's Pat, let her go, she's beautiful," and we would continue to make her beauty. We would continue to worship that beauty. But I'm writing a whole series of poems to my sister, now that she's dead, about like people really don't like beauty either, because people will violate beauty, a child's, a little girl's beauty also too. And but they said, you know, I came in and said, "Oh, that's Sonia, give her a book, she'll be okay." Honestly, you know, and she goes, everyone fell out laughing, but they left me alone. you know. And I maintain that the stuttering was a protective thing that protected me for years and years and years until I came out of high school, until I got back with my dad in a place called New York City at the age of 8. And even then, when I didn't need protection, then I continued to go, the amazing thing is that I wrote at that time. And the writing, the first writings I did was to my grandmother. This woman who loved me unconditionally, because she used to say to the aunts, just let the girl be, she be all right. She gonna stumble on gentleness one of these days. I am not sure that I have stumbled on gentleness, but what I did know is I stumbled on people who were like me, people who decided that they had to change the world, people who decided at some point that they would change the world. People who decided to, in spite of everything that was going on, in spite of parents and the people in the world, we decided to jump out there and say, you know, I am a black woman poet. And I did that in a place called New York City. And, you know, people got up and left. Those were black folks. So you ain't black, you're a Negro. And I remember I wanted to sink into the floor, but because I remember the history and herstory of my grandmother and those sisters in those churches, I stood my ground and said, yeah, that's what I am. And forevermore, we continue to do that. And so it was a blessing to be on stages, on the stages of the world, with all the people that Hakeem mentioned, the women who were our mothers, from Sister Margaret Walker, Miss Margaret, to Sister Gwen, who was a mother to everybody, to all Sister Sarah Fabio, who was a fine poet out west, Marvin X, who was a fine poet, you know, out west, all of these people, you know, who did so much work for all of us. What I remember about reading the first time to an audience is that I was stricken at how the words stayed on the page, and how at the same time I remember the language of my grandmother and the language of my father and jazz musicians, how their language sounds bounced off paper, went into some sacred space of broken tongues, re-entered the atmosphere at such a pace that their re-entry burned the edges of our souls and our ears as we listened, went home again. When I first heard some of the older poets read their words spread from the paper to our ears and back to their pages. And among those of us who listened, there was a recognition of poems well done, executed. Poems in keeping with the times, on-time poems, necessary poems, history, herstory poems. I think when they finally heard some of us read, they saw us look at the word, splice it, look up at the word, and jazz it up, look backwards at the word, and decide to disconnect and reconnect it at the end, stretch it, moan it, groan it, peel it, and then finally redress the world and say, see, this is a poem. And I saw other poets. I saw white poets begin to come and listen to how we read, because people didn't read like that or had not read in that fashion before. And our generation of black arts poets began to show poets how to read. These new poets, these hip-hop poets, heard the sound and picked it up. And they did the same thing we did with poetry and sound. They did the sound, the pace of sound, the swiftness of sound, the discordant way of looking at the world of sound, the blackness of sound, the color of sound, the beat of sound, and above all, it was that fast beat. It was what I call the new bebopic beat. Because when the bebop people started to play, nobody could keep up with them. It was so fast you couldn't even hear. I would always say to my kids when I first heard hip hop, I can't hear it, I don't understand. And the same kind of thing when Dizzy and Max were playing, nobody could play except them, and nobody could hear it. You had to have a fast ear to hear it, cause otherwise they would play it and done been gone. Same thing that happened with rap. It came at a fast pace, and if you turn your head, you missed it. It was gone, the bebop, the bam, and the hip-hop. Each generation brings something new to this thing called craft, to this thing called poetry. What we did when we looked at Margaret Walker and Gwendolyn Brooks, we went back into their herstory and history and pulled back from Langston Hughes, Sterling Brown, Dudley Randall, and Robin Hayden, that whole group. We pulled from them the craft of writing, the discipline of writing, and the history and herstory of our people. Then we said, let's bring it to a new sense of history. Let's, in a sense, reword history, refocus history with these new words and a new way of looking at the world. So we employed what they gave us along with what was going on in the world, the politics of being black, from civil rights to black power, to the new sense of self, to the new sense of who we are, were. And we came up with poems that did similar things that Miss Margaret and Sister Gwen and Brother Sterling Brown did. But we also, I think, began to give it a new Martin sound that was part of a 20th century sound. And I guess what I'm saying is that at some point, you had to look and see that their poetry was viable. It was another sound. It was a different sound. When Baraka, Askia, Haki, and Iskadet used the music of Monk, Coltrane, Dizzy, the blues of our people, we cut the century in half. We entered the century with the good news that the Africans were all alive and living in the diaspora. This is the very modernist way we looked at poetry. The world not ending with a whimper, but being full of ideas and sound and music that challenge everyone. What we have to learn, it seems to me, in this 21st century, is that we have been history and herstory, and we are history and herstory, and we have to unearth the history and herstory. To me, this 21st century is a serious time to look at ourselves, because there's a possibility that some of us will disappear in this 21st century as a significant force in world history. I would not have said that in the 20th century, but because we have not understood our history, we have allowed ourselves to be bought and killed out of history. I mean, there are people who allow us to be bought out of history. So at some point, it is necessary, it is incumbent upon us to look and see, as poets still poeting in the 21st century, how do I go out of my skin and return again with friends who will have something relevant to say? It might not be a new discussion, but it's something that comes up time and time again. And each poet has got to respond to it in some kind of way. Once when I was teaching in an elementary school, some of the little black kids were being chased home by some of the older white kids who were calling them nigger. And so I went home and wrote a poem and ellipsis, nigger, that word ain't shit to me. Don't you know where you at when you call me nigger? I'll say it slow for you, nigger. I know I'm black, beautiful, meaning nigger, my man, you way behind the set. Those children memorized that poem, and when they would chase, turn, and they would chase again, they stopped the chases, and they turned and said, that word don't turn me on, man, I know I am black. And they flaunted that blackness in the streets, and the white kids stopped in their tracks. And this is important. If they could chase someone with just one word, then they had the power. But if you could stop the word's importance by replacing it with something new, then you had the power. I tried to reinvent the word to give them the new power, and that's what you have to do. I empowered those children. They were being chased with a word, they were running, and when they stopped and turned with their interpretation of the word nigger, they were at a new place with themselves. They put the white kids on pause, a safe place to be, loving themselves in the middle of the 20th century. And what I feel about many of the young people writing at this point too, that their tongues caress the words with humor and irony and love, and we love them for doing that. And that's just part of a longer piece of essays that I'm doing on the 1960s and 70s. And also because I was a professor for 40 some odd years, I started to teach at a place called San Francisco State in 1967. And the significant thing about that is that we taught in San Francisco State, and one of the things that I did simply is that I taught black literature. But I taught black literature because I had the good fortune from Miss Hudson to meet Mr. Richard Moore on the bookstore and Mr. Michelle on the bookstore. And they both gave me bags full of books. So we got ready to start something called Black Lit, right? Someone said, Sanchez is always talking about these black books, you know, and said, you should be reading Du Bois or whatever. So I went to a place called San Francisco. My father said, don't go, don't go, don't go. And I went anyway. And I'm here to tell you that I went, and I'm not a revisionist. I'll tell you how naive I was, because I thought I was just teaching black literature. And what I was really teaching was more than that, because one Wednesday afternoon, there was a knock on my door, and my landlord came in and said, Professor Sanchez, there are two men who want to see you. And I said, and the guy went in his pocket and said, FBI. And I said, oh, is there something wrong? I said, because I live two blocks from Haight-Ashbury, and some of you might not know, but that's where the hippies used to live, right? And hang out. And the guy said, you're teaching Du Bois, Garvey, Hughes, Robeson. And this is how naive I was. I said, yes, I am. You cannot teach black literature without them. And the guy went, duh. You know, looking at me like, are you kidding? And he was furious at me. And he turned to my landlord and said, put her out. She's one of those, they didn't say rather, militants on the college campus. And I'm still not getting it. You know, and I keep saying, you know when you're in a foreign country and you don't speak the language and you think if you speak slowly, English slowly, they will understand. So I looked at the guy and said, yes, I teach black literature, you know, Du Bois, whatever. And this guy looks at me and he put his hand in my face again and said, you know, you're teaching. He was furious. Why was he furious? Because they had banned those people. No one taught them. You know what I'm saying? They said simply they're Reds. And so we young people coming along, not understanding that at all, said, boom, we're going to do this, you see. That's why every time I see a Dolores House, or I know at Rutgers, you know, now has Arnett Robeson, I cry. I go in those places and stand very quietly. Woo.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because what I say to the young people, you have got to understand that you're on time. You're always on time. You're always on time saying there's a, you know, there's a jungle out there. You're always on time when you say this, okay, you know. This is the time, not before your time. Someone said, we were before your time. So, you know, we were on time. We were saying the things we had to say so people could stay alive and live and be. And that was very, very important and very, very real. But you know, I had just been given by my Japanese American neighbor a Savoye, beautiful dog, that I come from New York City, we never had dogs at all. We could barely feed ourselves, much less a dog. And so I had these, I moved around that dog, you know what I mean? Whatever. And this, I heard these big feet come down the hallway, and he came and sat, there's no sat down and looked up at the two FBI men like this. And the man put his hand in my face, get that snow leap for him. And he said, lady, get your dog. And I said, no, with a new appreciation, actually, for that dog. But he sat down, and he kept looking at the guy. So I said, I opened the door and said, hey, this is over with. And they left. They said, you know, we're going to get you, kind of thing, right? And I came back, and I petted the dog for the first time. And I also said, I'm going to get you a steak, because they were in a house of vegetarians at that point, right? And I really got a steak for that dog also, too. But I'm saying simply that you must be on time.
Yes.
You've always got to be on time.
Yes.
You got to do the work that needs to be done. And many of us began to look up and understand, you know, that people were writing about what was going on in their community. That these young rappers, that these young hip-hop artists were writing about what was going on in their neighborhoods. You know what I mean? That the schools were bad. The children wanted to drop out of school, the schools were bad. You know, there were roaches every bloody place. You know, nobody cared. No one gave a damn at all. And they said, and I thought to myself, gee, that sounds just like Haki, you know, Baraka, you know, and all of us. And that's how we connected, because we understood and knew simply that what you were saying in hip-hop form, in this fantastic jazzy form, that sometimes you didn't even understand where it came from, you know, in a very real sense, but it was there. And I said, go on, brothers and sisters, go on and do it. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.